This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. After more than 2 years of civil war, famine, and cholera outbreaks, the country of Yemen is facing what observers call the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. Still, more than 100,000 teenagers from the Horn of Africa have made their way to Yemen by boat, based on a promise, usually by human traffickers, of finding work. Last week, one of those smugglers drowned some 50 of those seeking to better their lives. Joining us to shed some light on what's going on in Yemen are two experts. Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland. He served as president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies, and he's an affiliate scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Professor Schmitz is the co-author of Historical Dictionary of Yemen. Hamoud Sahi also joins us. He is professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's also a host of Swana Regional Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles and a commentator for Arabic media.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have both of you with us to talk about this really important issue, particularly what's going on in Yemen, but really Yemen in the context of regional geopolitics and the global geopolitics as well. So thank you both for joining us here. So let's start with the current situation. I've been reading about a magnitude of humanitarian crises that seems to be among the worst in the world. Charles Schmitz, how would you describe what is happening in Yemen?
It is a humanitarian disaster. It has multiple dimensions. There is the war and there's casualties from war. But the larger issue is that the Yemeni economy has been in a tailspin, and it basically has collapsed. So Yemen, through the 2000s, depended upon oil exports to import to pay for its consumer goods, basically. And the oil production has been totally stopped. A little bit has begun again, but the war disrupted it. The central bank has spent all of its foreign currency reserves. And Yemen depends entirely on imports for its food supplies. There are, you know, small amounts of food, but the basic staples of rice and wheat are wholly imported in Yemen. In addition to the fact that there is an air and sea blockade of the Houthi and Salak forces by the Saudi-backed coalition with the United States and the British. And they inspect the shipments that go in, and these have added a burden. But the real crisis is that the economy has collapsed and people don't have any money. You talk to people in Sana'a, the capital, which is in the Houthi-controlled areas, and there's food in the market. But what you don't see is that the bulk of people don't have the money to pay for it. So university professors, for example, are selling the furniture in their apartments in order to get some income to buy food. That's the real disaster.
I read also that doctors and nurses are dealing with a huge cholera outbreak and haven't been paid in months.
Nobody's been paid. The militias, soldiers get some pay. When either side gets any income, and both have some sources of income, they primarily support the war effort. So they're paying soldiers. So if you're a soldier or running a militia, you're okay. But others don't have their income. Yes, there's a cholera outbreak. It's a result of the collapse of the government and the lack of basic services. So garbage was not being collected. There is no electricity. And the water services have collapsed as well. So the combination of them led to a cholera outbreak, which my understanding is that they're beginning to get a handle on, but it was a real disaster there for a while.
So back up just a bit in terms of the economy and the collapse of the economy. Historically, you said it has been reliant upon oil income to buy basic things like food and pay for the government. So this is all connected to a geopolitical conflict, is it?
The collapse of the economy is not directly related to the fighting. So Yemen had a long-time ruler, Adab al-Salik. He came to power in 1978. He ruled Yemen kind of as a soft authoritarian. In other words, Yemen after 1990, when it unified with the South, the former communist South, they had elections, multi-parties, freer press. His system of sort of patronage worked as long as he had funds to pay for things. In the prior period, in the 80s and 90s, Yemen depended upon worker remittances. A lot of Yemenis worked in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, and they sent worker remittances back. And then in the 2000s and the beginning of this decade, Yemen depended upon oil exports. reports. And Salih's system broke down. And when the Arab Spring broke out in 2011, he couldn't contain it. He couldn't contain two big issues. One is the Houthi rebellion in the north, and the second was the calls for independence in the south, the former communist south. People there wanted to break away. And those two conflicts put pressure on the regime. He couldn't control it. In the Arab Spring, the inner core of his regime split in two, so some of his top military commanders split and went with the protesters. And then the Gulf states, in particular Saudi Arabia, stepped in, and they had the GCC agreement, which in effect was an agreement with the Yemeni elite, most of the Yemeni elite, in which Saleh would step down from power, but would remain in the country and would not be prosecuted for crimes of his regime. And that transitional government that began from 2012 and was supposed to go to 2014, everybody had great hopes for it. There was a national dialogue conference which all parties of Yemen came together to discuss, and including the southerners and including the Houthi in the north. But basically, that government failed. That government, backed by the Gulf states and by the United States and the international community, it didn't really have a lot of traction on the ground. And the Houthi movement began expanding from the north and came down. And unbeknownst to most, the former president allied with the Houthi and, in essence, took over Sana'a in a coup in early 2015. And the Houthi are friendly with the Iranians. They get some Iranian support, but very little. This is not Iraq or Hezbollah or even relations with the Syrian government. But the fact that the Houthi were friendly with the Iranians, the fact that the Houthi had basically turned over Saudi Arabia's key tribal alliances in the north of Yemen, and the Houthi now control them, this was very threatening to the Saudis. They launched a military campaign, which had a lot to do with internal Saudi politics as well, with the son of the king, who is the commander of the armed forces, and he's positioning himself to be king. He now is crown prince. The Saudis have rarely used their military extensively, and this is a major campaign that they are carrying out. And so this is a new symbolic forward policy for the Saudis that's connected with the crown prince's career. So it's very important to the Saudis. And so the Saudis and the Gulf states, they have a major, the Saudis have always had a major role in Yemen, but this is a particularly important role for them because they are intervening directly militarily.
Hamoud Salih, let's bring you in now. What would you add to this, both in terms of the current situation, the context with which we need to understand it, the sources of both the conflict and the economic collapse? What would you add?
Dr. Smith gave us an excellent overview. A few factors, the numbers a lot of time speak volume. The population, for example, of Yemen today is at around 27 million. Of those, over 18 million are in desperate need for basic necessities. You have more than 10 million who have serious problems. So we're talking about famine, and we're talking about huge malnutrition. Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world. It is expected that it will run out of water, if my memory doesn't fail me, by 2025. It's a country that has been sort of living in poor conditions for so many decades. It's ruled by alliances, centers around with a tribal leadership until 1996, when Dr. Schmidt talked a lot about this system. But a point that we need to emphasize is that the country was divided between the north and the south. The south was under brand of socialism. The north was morally aligned with the Saudis to a large degree. And then you have the Al-Qaeda that came into a perspective. Another reason one should look at is that the geopolitics of Yemen is very important. Back in 1981, when the Gulf Cooperation was created, Yemen is literally in the Gulf, but the GCC countries, including led by Saudi Arabia, refused to include them for two reasons. One is that it has a different system, and the other one, it was seen as it has a form of government that was not acceptable. It's different. It's somewhat, linking non-monarchical as the other states are. But it was strategic. It was very strategic for Yemen to have. The Yemenis, because of the vast majority of the population, provide labor to the GCC, and they are mistreated in more ways than one. What added to this crisis, to this recent crisis, is that when you define it as geopolitical, Yemen cannot be looked at outside what's happening in the Arab world. When we look at the Middle East as a system, you have the system is in crisis. The Arab world system has failed, and there is no reason for any hope. And what's happening in Yemen is the same thing that is happening elsewhere in Bahrain and to some degree in Syria. So it is representative of the failure of the Arab system. Second is the competition or the race for the hegemonic control of the Gulf region, namely between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Yemen became the center of a proxy war. The Saudis sees as a way for them to stop or to undermine or to control Yemen in ways to protect their national interests. And the Iranians see this as a way to expect to give them strategic depth in the region. That kind of arms race in the region has impacted Yemen. The fact that today we have no Arab solution to the conflict, not a single interest, despite what's happening in Yemen, in malnutrition, in death, in tragedies unfolding in our race, there is no interest in it. It has in part because of the strategic fight that is between these two regional powers. And lastly, one should not ignore the health issues that are happening with cholera, as you mentioned correctly earlier. So a lot of ways, tragedy is unfolding before our eyes, and we continue to watch it. The Yemenis more and more going through from tragedy to another.
You know, we've been talking about the regional geopolitics, and you mentioned, Hamoud, about the other geopolitics and the potential role that can be played there. It seems that there is very little interest, as you alluded to, from the West, but there is some interest coming from, say, China now to take on a role of humanitarian aid. How do you see the West in all of this and its ostensible disinterest?
Well, you know, this is the challenge. What we've seen in the West is that the Middle East is used through two eyes, one through the Israeli politics and the other one, most recently, is through terrorism. Well, Yemen is looked at through the eyes of terrorism. So United States sends drones, kills people there, hurts civilians, and we call them casualties of war, and that's it. So we hear about instances of drones killing or doing some major damage to the country. At that time, we hear about it. So that prism of looking at at Yemen in the interest of terrorism continues to prevail. As long as we are containing the threat of terrorism, of Al-Qaeda from expanding to the region, we are okay. And in that matter, you'll see Dr. Schmidt, for example, talked about oil. Well, one of the oil revenues or the oil areas are being controlled these days by the United Arab Emirates, and they are using non-governmental organizations as an umbrella to steal the oil resources and the gas resources from Yemen. The UAE is using Yemeni gas to compensate for what it's losing from its policy towards sanctioning Qatar. So again, here is an instance where what we may call international steal or pillage of a country, but it's also ignored. The idea of getting the West interested in Yemen under the current conditions is difficult to catch. And Yemen is not sexy, as their children seems to be not the same children as the one that showed up on the beaches of European with the Syrians and others. So it's very puzzling. And when you look at the tragedy, more than 60% of the population is severely under major dangers of losing their lives. That's really, it's a puzzle. So strategic goals, the roles that the Saudis play, the roles that the UAE is playing, is very significant. And add to this something that it's very important to look at, the change in leadership in the Gulf countries, in Saudi Arabia, in United Arab Emirates, even to Qatar, is playing a big, big, big role in this. The new leadership, it's a young leadership, educated in the West, having strong connection to the Western world, seems to care less about resolving conflict peacefully. It's the type of leadership that we have not seen in the past. The older leadership with Sheikh Zayed, for example, in United Arab Emirates, or Abdullah, or even Faisal, if you go back, they were able to work within a system to at least resolve those conflicts in ways that are in a bit human. And this new leadership seems to know how to address issues of the Western presence and seems to tack into it for its pure interest. And perhaps that also play a role in not shedding the lights that was supposed to be on this region, on Yemen specifically, yeah.
Charles Schmidt, what do you say to all of that? Do you see it in the same way?
It's quite a lot. Let's see. The last point about sort of the new military forward policies of the Emirates and the Saudis, they've been buying military equipment for a long time, but they haven't really used it. So this is the first time they've ventured out on their own with the military. I would add to this that the United States and the European Union and the British have been very involved in Yemen. They were big backers of the transitional government, and they've been very concerned about what's going on. The Dutch in particular do a lot of work in Yemen. And there's a lot of relief work that's going on. But there was kind of a shift from the Obama to the Trump administration in the sense that the Obama administration tried to give Iran a place in the Middle East, to give it some sort of role that could be used to mold its behavior in such a way that it had an interest in the regional order. And the Trump administration rejects that. And they basically adopt the Gulf states' view of the conflict, which is that the primary problem, the primary enemy in the Middle East is Iran. And this has played out in Yemen. Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, he was the commander of the Central Command, which is that region. He served under Obama for a while, and then he left. And he was always critical of the failure in his eyes to stop Iranian expansion. And so they see this conflict in that light. But I think it's really important to say that it really doesn't fit that mold. In other words, the Iranians have spent nothing on Yemen, and they only see Yemen important in as much as it bothers the Saudis. This they like, that it has engaged the Saudis, that the Saudis are spending a lot of money on the war, that the Saudis are stuck in intractable conflict. The Iranians like this because it grinds the Saudis down, it grinds their military capabilities down. It was zero investment for the Iranians. This is not Hezbollah. This is not something where they spent a lot of time and effort developing. And the Iranians do not play a big role. Remember that the Houthi are under a naval and air blockade. Nothing gets in there without the UN inspecting it goes in. If the Iranians are getting in there, it's got to be smuggled in. And Yemen is famous for its smuggling. So, yes, this is one of the ways that the Houthi and Salak are staying around. But this is primarily about Saudi Arabia's influence. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and Yemen is very much like the United States and Mexico. The United States fears Mexico. It fears Mexico because of its poverty and its problems, its lack of state capacity spilling into the United States. And the Saudis feel the same about Yemen. They are afraid of Yemen because of its chaos. It's not a place that there's a strong central government. And so Al-Qaeda and other non-state actors, they can use it as a base, and they have used it as a base for attacks on Saudi Arabia. And the Gulf used to rely on Yemeni labor, but they don't like Yemeni labor. They prefer South Asian and Southeast Asian labor. because they'll make no claims to citizenship. They'll make no claims to rights. Whereas Yemenis who are culturally close and understand, they will make claims. They will say, you know, you're not treating us right. And so they much prefer South Asian labor to Yemeni labor. And so then what do they do with Yemen? Well, what the Saudis and the Gulf would like is to control it in such a way that Yemen is stable enough so that Yemenis stay there and Yemen doesn't implode and, you know, send many poor people across the border. Of course, their intervention has done exactly that. So it seems to have backfired. I wanted to say one more thing. Dr. Hamoud said something very important, and that is that, you know, we don't have Yemeni children washing up on beaches. Yemenis don't get the attention that, say, the Syrians or the Iraqis or others do because Yemenis are trapped. You can't get out. There's no way to get out of Yemen. Syrians can run across the border to Lebanon. They can go to sea. They can cross the Mediterranean, et cetera, et cetera. Iraqis can do this as well. The Yemeni can't. And so because there is no Yemeni component to the refugee crisis in Europe, they don't get as much attention.
You know, it's interesting, the issue about being trapped, and then the big news item this week about the smuggled Ethiopians and Somalis that were drowned off the coast of Yemen. How do we make sense of all of this?
As incredible as it sounds, Yemen is the poorest Arab country. But Yemen is about on par with the average of sub-Saharan Africa. And Somalis are much worse off. And so the direction of migration is from Somalia to Yemen. And there are Somali refugee camps along the south. And recently they've been in the news because it's not clear exactly why, but the Somali smugglers have feared Yemeni gunboats, probably, and they've been dumping their human cargo farther off the coast, and many of them have drowned. And that has just started in the last, like, 2 weeks. There's been a number of incidents where the smugglers simply force everybody at gunpoint off the boat and too far off the coast, and so a lot of them drown when they're coming in. It's not clear why people speculate that some sort of Yemeni security is, because they're not supposed to do this. This is illegal. And it's ironic that Yemenis can't get out of their crisis, but here Somalis are being added to it.
I was wondering, now, they are locked in because they're obviously on the sea on one side, and on the other, is it just they just can't get through the borders?
Right. There are no flights out of Sana'a right now. You could smuggle yourself across the border into Oman. But see, it's got a border with Oman, and the longest border is with Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, is a war zone, and they've cut it off. And then there are boats. There's no real way, you know, to sort of, I don't want you to get on a raft, try and float through the Suez Canal. I don't think it's possible. So there's really no place to go.
And so we were going to talk through now possible ways of making a big difference for these people in Yemen who are clearly going to starve to death and die of disease if some things aren't done. I know there's humanitarian aid coming in, but clearly this can't go on just based on humanitarian aid. What are the, you know, economic, political solutions that need to occur?
There has to be negotiations between the Houthi and Salak. Salak is the former ruler, and he's allied himself with the Houthi. There has to be negotiation between Salak and the Houthi and the Saudis on the one hand, and Houthi and Salak and the Hadi government, which is the Saudi-backed government, which is in Riyadh and in Aden. There has to be negotiations with them. But the difficulty is that the Hadi government has UN Resolution 2216, which calls for the restoration of the Hadi government in Sana'a and the withdrawal of the Houthi from the cities. In essence, it's asking to give Hadi what they couldn't achieve on the battleground. So it's not a very workable solution at this point. What needs to happen is a gradual de-escalation where kind of a third power can emerge. It's not Salak and Houthi, and it's not the Hadi government, but it is a neutral set of powers that can oversee the formation of a new national reconciliation government. And it sounds pie in the sky, but in Yemen it's not. They've done such things. And in fact, in early 2016, There were negotiations in Dahran al-Janubi, which is in Saudi Arabia, where they actually started to do this, and they put together military committees to de-escalate the various conflicts, areas in the conflicts. And it has to be that kind of thing. It's not going to be kind of a, you know, a UN conference and blah, blah, blah. It's going to be a step-by-step, area-by-area de-escalation, military de-escalation, and you start to build trust between the parties. And there has to be a national reconciliation government, which is neither Houthi nor on the Hadi side.
Hamoud Salhi, do you agree?
Those are really some fundamental issues that we have to deal with. But there are a couple other things that might be sort of also important. I think one of the issues, if we look at some of the resolutions that have been passed in the Security Council at this point, there is a path for some kind of reconciliation. There is some kind of path for rewriting the Constitution, for drafting a national government in ways that would be sort of creating a balance, giving some power to the Houthis at the national level. So there has been some discussion, there has been some progress on that. I think the biggest problem is with the Syrian conflict and then the humanitarian issue, which creates more and more problems. And of course, with that sorted out, you have the issue of terrorism. A solution to Yemen is closely linked with other issues. Syria is a bit far, but it's also linked to Bahrain, where Iran, despite Dr. Schmidt is very correct when he's saying that their involvement in Yemen are not to the extent that what is being portrayed in the media. But Bahrain is a very important case to look at. Again, you have a Shia population supported by Iran. You still have the Shia in Bahrain struggling, and you have rest that continue to be a problem. So the issue of resolving Yemen could be linked to resolutions at the regional level between the Saudis and the Iranian, and play linking those issues. What we've seen in the 90s, late 90s, when Khatami was in power, the Gulf countries, the leaders of that region, saw a detente, or the Iranians and the Saudis and the entire GCC at the time, except for the United Arab Emirates, reached out to the Iranians, Mohammed Said Khatami, and there were relationship that today still exists, particularly those between the Qataris and the Iranians. The point is this, there is a way out also for the Yemenis to, if the main regional powers are able to sort of resolve or come to a consensus on an agreement on how to put their differences aside. This, of course, is linked to Syria and linked to other issues, but there is also some important issue. There's something to do there. The other thing is that we slowly start to see the importance of this colonial or post-colonial entity, the Arab League, that had some power in the past, albeit, you know, very, very weak. But the fact that bringing leaders to the forum, bringing the Arab leaders to a place where they can negotiate and discuss with each other, that brought some kind of appeasement or resolution to conflicts. The Saudis, for example, were notorious for bribing other leaders to ensure that the conflict don't expand. So you have those kind of approaches were successful. Recently, there has been some declaration from the Secretary General of the Arab League pointing out to the need to remind the Arab leaders and the international players or countries of the need to respect the Arab state sovereignty and not to go into this idea of continuously fragmenting the state from another. But the significance of that is that the Arab League could also play a role in this, despite its weakness, in bringing all the parties together. So I guess from one perspective, one could be saying that there are a lot of parts to this resolution, but in the end, what will sort of play a role in this is having a balanced approach between all parties. We've seen, for example, that the Saudis are continuously promoting al-Hadi and presenting him as the president of the country at the expense of other groups. So doing a balance, promoting leaders, Dr. Schmidt talked about other players, is a very, very significant. A deeper issue is the relationship between the North and the South. This is a long conflict, and the plan in the Constitution of dividing the country into several provinces. So there are some ways is there to work on, but it takes dedication, it takes also belief in the process, and more than anything else, it takes the Yemenis to be on the same page and agreeing that for the sake to protect their countries, that foreign presence or foreign interference should stay out.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and your thoughts and your research.
Thank you.
Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland, and he's an affiliate scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Professor Schmitz is the co-author of Historical Dictionary of Yemen. Hamoud Sahi is professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's a commentator for Arabic media. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.